Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. One of the goals of this radio program is to capture the oral history of queer San Francisco over the decades. We have films, we have books, but we haven't yet fully recorded our voices, so we're chipping away right here. My guest is one of the most infamous characters of the San Francisco scene in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. She refers to herself with many labels, including witch, bitch, whore, and faghag. She performed with the infamous Coquettes, White Trash Boom Boom. She wrote Gay Widow, a collection of AIDS survivor stories. She's an actor, playwright, and screenwriter, and a knitter. We'll get to that. She's lived to tell her story in her memoir, My Life, a four-letter word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva. It's a story about family, the one that rejected her when she gave birth to her biracial daughter, and the one that embraced her and helped her raise her daughter in the queer community. Dolores Deluce, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Hi, how are you?
So great to have you on, and your book is just tremendous, and it's just, you know, your life defines sex and drugs and rock and roll, as far as I'm concerned. You've lived it, rock and roll theater, for that matter.
You could say that, yes.
What did writing this memoir show you, or how did it help you?
Oh, many ways. First of all, it showed me that I really am a survivor. You know, sometimes I forget that. And I've had an amazing, colorful, wonderful life that brings me to a point at this age in my life. It may not be as exciting as it once was, but I have so much gratitude for all the experiences, the friends, the ones living and not living, that I've encountered along the journey, you know, so I have nothing but love in my heart in honoring these friends and people of my story, as well as my family.
Both families,
both
your original
families.
Family and the family you created.
You got it. The family that embraced me and I helped create. Yes.
Well, that's what we do when we're spurned by our original families. We go and find other family, don't we?
That's true. I think that is what a survivor does. Yeah.
Right. You find the love somewhere. If you can't get it at home, you go and make another home. And that's what
exactly.
You did.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is just, it really is like a rock and roll read. It's wild. You did wild things. You took a lot of drugs. You had a lot of sex. You did a lot of shows. You had a lot of friends and lovers. And you had your daughter all along throughout most of that. And so I just want people to know more about this. It made the top 20 on Amazon. It's just a tremendous read. And I wanted to have you read from it. I thought we'd start with an excerpt from the beginning of the book. And this is your first show with the Coquettes now in North Beach, right? And you were on acid?
Yes, I was. It was my very first show ever in my life, except for when I was in high school, in the senior play. And it was, one of my earlier acid. I had taken a little acid, but this was a full-blown acid trip that was going on simultaneously while I was on stage performing with the Coquettes for the first time. And this is like a little excerpt of what was going on before the show started. In the opening chapter. So I'll read from that. When we drove past the Palace movie theater looking for parking, a mushroom cloud of marijuana smoke hovered over a sea of creatures of the night, costume freaks, transvestites, transients, and hookers were waiting for the Chinese patrons to vacate their movie theater. The smell of weed, chemicals, and incense followed us for several blocks to where I finally parked in a back alley. Prissy and I chanted, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, to surround my VW bus with white light that would hopefully deflect the police from noticing I parked in a red zone. As we walked toward the stage door, a streetcar dropped off a whole load of Judy Garland lookalikes, and they were all singing, clang, clang, clang goes the trolley, ding, ding, ding goes the bell. And then they joined the crowd in front of the theater as we slipped into the backstage door. When I finally got to a mirror, my makeup was a wreck, and the giant lashes were sticking to my cheeks. With 5 minutes to showtime, everyone was frantic. Suddenly, someone noticed that Prissy was missing, and I volunteered to help. She was outside, rolling in the gutter in her drag, a magnificent gold lamé couture gown made with inverted bra cups that accentuated the obvious. She was the flat-chested, ugly stepsister. I picked up her wig and, with the help of two hot, hunky guys, lured her back inside the theater. Prissy insisted on bringing through the stage door a gang of her fans for a free show. So it was just a taste of what happened before the show.
I just can't imagine, as a performer, I can't imagine performing on acid. I just think, how do you remember your lines? You're like, well, what lines? Why do I have to say these words now? You know, you just...
Well, there were no lines. Luckily, I was dancing. I was an all-dancing pumpkin in a drag version of Cinderella. That's what that story is about. So I just had to remember the choreography of the Tchaikovsky number we were doing modern dance to, which was a tall feat in itself.
Well, let's paint a bit of a picture of you back then. You're buxom, you're short, you're a hippie mama living communally, you're doing theater with these queers in San Francisco. You're the star of the scene, and yet there are many stars of that scene, Crumbly Colwyn and,
yes,
and all of the people from the Coquettes. And it's quite a scene back then, right?
Oh, my God, it was amazing. It was like a whole fairyland opening to a new world for me when I met some of the characters that would become my family members, which I had no idea would happen. When I met Divine the year before I moved to San Francisco to perform, I went to see one of these Coquette shows, and Divine was a guest star, and that opened my eyes to a wonderful world that I had no idea existed. And from that moment on, I was convinced that I had to be a part of it.
Now, Divine, so, yeah, for those of you who don't know, was the star, now deceased, of the filmmaker John Waters' Pink Flamingos and Hairspray. And you call yourself,
yes,
the illegitimate daughter of Divine because she was very motherly towards you, yes?
Divine was very motherly, yes. To me, especially, I don't know what it was. People often said when I got into drag, I looked like a mini Divine because we had the same curves. And you know, he was my trainer and mentor. So, I think there's a lot of Divine in me. And when we just bonded. The first day we met, we had a lot of commonality. We loved to eat. We loved food. We loved to cook. I mean, you know, it just was amazing. And then he ended up shortly after we first met asking me if he could come visit me in Venice with a friend right after his show closed. And I embraced the idea of it. You know, I had two gay roommates at the time, and I had my daughter was two. And I said, by all means, you know, come. I'm going to have the world-renowned Divine, the biggest drag queen in the world, come stay with me. And he arrived with an entourage. They were supposed to come for a weekend, and they ended up living with me for over a month because Divine decided he had to have a Venice apartment, you know, to avoid the cold summers of San Francisco. And it was just party central from the moment he arrived. It was amazing.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Dolores Deluce. Her memoir, My Life, A Four-Letter Word, is on the bookshelves now and on the Kindles now, and you can check her out on Amazon, and you can also go to counterculturediva.com. You can follow her on Twitter at deluxediva. Yes, there we are. Now, I thought you'd read about Divine from your book.
Okay, I have a lot in the book about Divine. I'll read a tiny little bit of when he arrived in the apartment that night, my little two-bedroom apartment in Venice, with himself, his boyfriend, David Baker Jr.'s boyfriend, another actor, and Lorenzo Glover, his name was, and Lorenzo's dog. And they all moved into my little bedroom in the back of the house, and I was displaced in the living room with my daughter. So this was the opening night of that adventure.
What year was this?
This was 1972.
Okay.
Yeah. And this was prior to me doing my first show in San Francisco. On the first night of their arrival, my hunch about Divine being family from another planet was confirmed. Within moments of walking through the door, Divi, as I called him, pulled out a thank you joint and offered it to me and my roommates. Doran, my pot-dealing roommate, lit the joint and took a long, deep inhale. "Now, careful, girls. This is no ordinary joint," Divine said. "This stuff has been dipped in amyl nitrate." Doran's eyes rolled back in his head as he handed the joint off to me. "I inhaled plenty of amyl fumes on the disco floor," I told Divine. I'm just saying, hon, it's very different when smoked than snorted. Throwing all caution to the wind, I took a hit. With a taste of rocket fuel on my tongue, I was catapulted into the outer limits. Luckily, the trip only lasted seconds because it was so intense that had it gone on any longer, I may have never returned to Earth. After one little taste, my human DNA was seriously rearranged, and the deal was sealed. Divine and I were bonded through all eternity. Nothing like drugs to keep the family together.
Sex and drugs and rock and
exactly.
roll.
Exactly. Oh, there's plenty of that, too, that Divine and I were both in some situations together.
Oh,
I'll
Lord.
Let the reader find that out for themselves.
And the men, you loved so many men, and they loved you, and you loved a lot of gay men, and you were lovers with a lot of gay men.
I was one of the lucky few. I was never one of those kind of fag hags that, you know, chased gay men like conquest, you know. It always would happen by accident, you know. It's sort of like, it was just an extension of the friendship and the love that so many gay men and I had for one another. And I think because I was so open, and it was the times, the 70s, and the drugs. Yeah, and the drugs were flowing. A lot of these deep, loving friendships just somehow turned into romances and sexual encounters. And even when the sex was over, we would just go right back to being who we were to one another, you know, when it wasn't a meant to be. And then some of them lasted longer. They were, you know, full on affairs for a while. And even when those were over, we still loved each other forever. You know, it was just magical in that way, you know. I never
and you also got your heart broken a few times from some of them.
Oh, yes.
Just kind of wishing maybe they weren't gay.
Exactly. Wishing that we could. I didn't mind that they were gay. I just wanted them to be mine. And then, yeah, there was some heartache. But, you know, even with the heartache, you know, it would still be okay after a while. You know, like I'd get over the initial adjustment, you know, that this is not going to be my guy forever.
Now, did people and then I'd judge you for this? Or the people, you know, were you looked at in a sort of judgmental way as like, what's wrong with you? Or, you know, why are you picking on the gay man? I mean, what was that like?
Well, I think most of my gay friends didn't, of course, because they understood. Like my roommate Marshall used to say, oh, girl, you got fag attraction. You know, some of them were jealous because I was sleeping with the men they wanted to be sleeping with.
I bet. That's what I'm saying.
You know, yeah, that kind of thing. But I wasn't a part of the straight world back in those days. I was completely immersed in the gay counterculture, especially in the 70s. So, yeah, so there was nobody really to judge me except, you know, like jealousy amongst my peers, that kind of thing.
Well, and by the time the 80s came along, within a few years of the 80s, which the early 80s were like the 70s anyway, you know, it's always like that with the decades. And then AIDS came in.
Yeah, and that's
when AIDS came
really
in,
changed.
That just kind of changed everything. And you've been served, as you write in the book, I'm talking with Dolores DeLuce here on Out in the Bay, you've been served by some of these visions that you've had, these dreams that you've had, these feelings that you've had, this sort of clairvoyance. You've had some things that have guided you throughout your life that you write about in the book. And I think that, AIDS is one of them.
Yeah, there were early warnings for me, like on a psychic level. Like you say, I've had some prophetic dreams in my life that were actually very clear, and especially with hindsight, when I looked back on them, when AIDS finally did surface, I knew exactly what those dreams were telling me, and it was really uncanny. I've always had this bit of a psychic ability. I've always called myself a reluctant psychic because I never take it seriously, and I don't even put much stock into getting readings from other psychics for me. But yeah, there is a part of me that had known things were happening even before they were. And then when it started to happen, of course, it was devastating. And it was miraculous that I even was not HIV positive and didn't succumb to the virus, because I had slept with more than 25 men that are dead, you know, from AIDS. But I think my time frame of stopping those behaviors happened before the virus was really taking a stronghold in the community. Yeah.
So but you must have worried about it until we figured out what
it
was from and the tests and all that.
Well, of course. I mean, I didn't worry about it for myself at first because I somehow didn't connect it. You know, like most people in our world, we didn't necessarily connect it with sex in the beginning, the mm-hmm. very beginning.
Well, it was called a gay cancer, right? We didn't know how
exactly.
It spread.
Yeah, and I lost some very early friends, like back in '82. The guy Patrick Cowley, mm-hmm. who wrote all of Sylvester's disco track music, you know, the music itself, the electronic music. He died. He was one of the early victims of the gay cancer. And then, of course, by 86, I started losing my friends pretty rapidly from 86 into the mid-90s.
That's right.
And it was devastating.
Including
absolutely
Sylvester,
devastating.
Who died in 1988. And
yeah,
you were very connected to Tim, his manager, and his partner, and Sylvester.
Yeah, I was. In the early days, even before Sylvester was super famous, he was famous in San Francisco, and he had been famous with the Cockettes, and he was one of the few Cockettes that climbed into mainstream, you know,
right.
recognition. So I knew him back in the day in 73, 74. John McGuire, who is also my lover, one of the many husbands that I call my gay husbands, was lovers with his husband, Tim McKenna, who managed Sylvester. So John and I were privy to so many wonderful evenings with Sylvester at the City back in San Francisco. It was a big disco floor on the top and then a kind of a nightclub cabaret downstairs. I don't know if you remember it.
I don't. Where was that?
A lot of people. It was, that neighborhood. It was, I'm trying to remember exactly where the location was. It was sort of downtown. It was sort of between North Beach and downtown. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly mm-hmm. the street it was on. But I spent a lot of nights there, and Sylvester used to do these amazing performances, like part gospel, part soul blues. He'd sit at the piano and, you know, blew me away. And we used to go to his house afterwards for after-hours parties. And so, yeah, so that was an amazing time. And I always loved Sylvester. Taught me how to hold court in bed, you know, entertain after the show, take off his wig and drag and just sit in a kimono, you know, in bed and smoke a joint with everybody. It was so much fun.
Well, and you were at his memorial, and he mapped it out and planned it out brilliantly.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Can you read that passage from the book?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, because John took me, actually. John, I'll read this right here. It says, by the mid-80s, my sweet friend, John McGuire, had become a successful L.A. interior designer and lived with his new partner, Winston Wilde, on his ranch in Malibu. He was closer than a brother to me and my daughter, Viva, and we were always included in every one of his large family gatherings. When Sylvester died, John offered to fly me to Oakland with him to pay homage to our mutual friend at his memorial at the Oakland Love Center. John and I held hands as we joined the procession of Sylvester's family, friends, and hundreds of fans. The event was reminiscent of our days at the Black Gospel churches, as hats, furs, and fans were flying, and many were testifying, but no one louder than the deceased himself. Sylvester's falsetto tones rang out loud and clear over the cries and shouts of the congregation as we stomped and shouted to his biggest hit, "You Make Me Feel Mighty Real." As we approached the church altar with the open casket on display, John gripped my hand. There Sylvester lay in all his glory, every last detail selected by his own hand. Red lips to match the red oriental silk kimono, gold eyeshadow to highlight the brocade stitching. It couldn't get any realer than that.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Dolores DeLuce. Her memoir, My Life, a Four-Letter Word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva, details the 60s, 70s, and 80s in San Francisco and Los Angeles. You can find out when she's in your area with her book at counterculturediva.com. That's counterculturediva.com, Dolores DeLuce. Let's talk a little bit about your New Jersey family. You were rejected by them for having a child with a black man. And then you finally had a reunion, though, and that sort of had some closure for you at the end.
Right. Well, there was a lot. Yeah, a lot went on, and it tied to travel through this story in the book as well. The Italian, you know, Catholic, old world immigrant family that I came out, just couldn't accept the lifestyle I'd chosen for myself. And the clincher was having a black baby out of wedlock, you know, and that put put the, you know, I was disowned for a while. But over the years, you know, we started to reconcile, and little by little, my father started to come around. And by the mid-70s, they arrived in San Francisco kind of to try to bury the hatchet and decide they were going to accept their daughter and their grandchild. And they arrived in the middle of the circus, which was quite an amazing thing that they
lived through. It's a great story in the book. It's a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a long, yeah, I wouldn't read from that, but it's, there were a lot of stuff that happened.
Yeah.
And they were pretty cool about it, but it didn't solve all the problems. And then by the end of the book, though, we totally did reconcile, and I was there for my father and at his passing, actually. And it was because I had been through so many bedside, you know, deaths over that period. My father died right around the same time all my friends were dying. So I had a lot of experience in helping my dad pass over to the other side, which was pretty miraculous and was really the final piece. You know, he really recognized who I was and acknowledged me for it too. And said he always said he wished he had the courage to live the life that I lived, which was so amazing to hear that from him.
Healing,
you know,
yes.
Really, it was healing, so healing, yeah.
And your daughter, Viva, now she's a grown woman. She's a blues and jazz singer. She's quite the star.
Yeah.
What's that like for you to have raised a star? You were a star, and then you raised an even bigger star.
Oh, my God. You got it. Well, I think it's as it should be. The child should surpass the parent, you know? My daughter was raised by me, not alone, you know? She had the influence of all these incredibly talented, gifted people influencing her life. So there was no way she was not going to come out a diva like her mama, you know? And I'm her biggest fan. I love her to death. And it was the best choice I ever made in my life was to have my daughter, Viva. She's in Singapore right now, singing her heart out, you know, like she goes around the world in these tours and contracts. And then she comes back to LA and she has a life here too. And you know, we're really like joined at the hip. And I've traveled to Asia many times just to be with her when she's been gone too long, so that I could, you know, hang out with her in whatever country she's in. It's been pretty wild. Our relationship's very solid and fabulous.
Well, you've been through a lot, and she's been through a lot. I mean, there were a lot
of moves.
She's been
through a lot.
A lot of moves
to
different cities and different houses and different men and women. But, you know, a lot of different people she was, you know, privy to being around as a child. And for some reason, I think maybe that's why she's so normal. Maybe that was a good thing, right?
Well, yeah. You know, friends always say, God, your daughter, especially like in her teen and early 20s, she was so hardworking and she had such integrity. She was always so honest and clear and generous and kind. And people would say, how did you get such a good daughter? You know, she's so ethical and all these things when you raised her in this crazy world. You know, we were shoplifters and we were, you know, revolutionaries and we were all these things. And, you know, I said, well, it skips a generation, you know. It's like lucky for me that she came out so healthy. I mean, she didn't do drugs. She doesn't drink. I mean, she's a pretty straightforward girl, except she's not straight in that sense. You know, I mean, she's really open and creative, but she just doesn't do any of those destructive behaviors because for some reason she saw us doing it and decided it was not for her,
which
is a good thing.
What do you think? My guest is Dolores DeLuce here on Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. What do you think it is that helped you survive it and not die of a drug overdose? Or, you know, what is it that, why are you, what healed you? What helped you get away from all the destructive behavior that you talk about in the book?
Well, I had a lot of spiritual influences in my life, you know, and I think that that was the main thing. It was a lot of grace. I talk about in a chapter called Guru about an initiation I had into a meditation practice in 1980, which sort of plucked me out of the world in a very real way. You know, suddenly I didn't find myself longing for a lot of sexual activity in my life. I was sort of struck celibate along with this meditation practice. It wasn't the intention, you know. It wasn't the teaching of the guru, but somehow that just happened. And I think in some way it sort of saved me from further diving deeper into darkness. And also having a daughter saved me. I mean, I really think that having Viva in 1970 was like sort of my first spiritual awakening. And it held me back from a lot of behavior that I probably would have abandoned myself to recklessly. You know, not that I say I was completely not reckless after I had her, but I think I slowed down a lot. Mm-hmm. I even think at one point in the book I say Viva was like a speed bump, you know, on my road to self-destruction.
Well, that sounds about right. It slowed you down. It helped you wake up and slow down a little bit.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So no, I think it's a lot of luck, a lot of grace and everything else, you know.
Do you miss your friends who died of AIDS? Do you think about them much?
Oh, all the time. I mean, some of them that have been gone more than 20 years or more, it still feels like yesterday to me. You know, they still visit me in my dreams and, they're always a part of me. I just feel like I'm surrounded by them still mm-hmm. to this day, but not in a sad way, you know, mm-hmm. like I feel empowered by it sort of, you know, mm-hmm. just feel like they're here. They're still cheering me on like they did when they were in my audience. And I love them all still to this day. And I know one day I'll be with them, you know, I don't know when, but you know, we're all going to go there eventually.
I want to also include, just as we wrap this up, that you are a knitter. You're the knitter to the stars. Lily Tom and Julia Roberts, you're a knitter. That's amazing.
I'm a grand knitter. I learned as a child, but I picked it up in the early 80s again, and it became a career. I was in acting class knitting, you know, just compulsively, and other actresses would see what I was making, and they were booking big commercials, famous, you know, actresses, and some of them married to Rod Stewart, and lots of people, you know, P. Isadora, you name it. I did stuff for them even before I became like the official knitter to the stars, and then took it to a world, as a not local, but, you know, national level, you know, through Saks and Bergdorf's. I had accounts. But then I just kept doing it by hand and continue to this day to do it. I don't do so much for the studios and celebs anymore, but I still knit and I still sell my work. And I've had a million and one jobs and multi-careers just to keep surviving in show business because I never wanted a real job. I needed to always be available for auditions.
I hear you.
So I was Dean Martin's maid for 2 years. I've done, you know, I had a personal assistant business called Tell Mama. I did everything catering and organizing. As an organizer, I became a spokesperson for a different media campaign because I created a comedic character called Iona Place, the Diva of Decluttering, and I was sent on a national tour for a storage company. I mean, I've done a gazillion things, and actually my second book is about that period of my life. It sort of picks up where this book lets out, like in the 90s and how I, you know, 80s and 90s.
What's
and
it called?
It's called Blowjobs, A Guide to Making It in Show Business or Not. It's
Listen,
like How Not To from the Counterculture Diva.
Thank you. You know, you're a survivor and you're a tremendous human being, and the book is a tremendous read. I really want to appreciate, thank you, say thank you, and I appreciate you coming on the radio show. It was just wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You bet. Thanks
Take
again.
Care.
Bye-bye. Dolores DeLuce, you can find her book, My Life, a Four-Letter Word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva, on Amazon at counterculturediva.com. And please check her out, her readings, etc., at her website. You've been listening to Out in the Bay. It's a weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. Our show streams and is on the air every Thursday at 7 p.m. Pacific, and then we archive it at outofthebay.com for podcasts. You can get us on your phone. Just go to outinthebay.com and download the Stitcher app. And check us out on our Playing Favorites page on our website. We put up some of our best shows over the last 8-9 years, Ang Lee, Sylvester, John Waters. Keep us on the air. Make a donation. Out of the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org, LRIS, sfbar.org/LRIS. Write us. My email is Marilyn at Out in the Bay. Eric Jansen's is Eric at outinthebay.com. Thanks to the staff and management of KALW, David LaTulipe is our engineer here in San Francisco. Thanks also to Angie Hamilton-Lowe and Patrick Murray at NPR West in Los Angeles. Out of the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me.